We want to empower the individual, protect the small guy. We have a mistrust of central authority. We believe in freedom of information.
What up, vigilantes? Thank you for being with us today. I have an amazing guest, someone that we've looked up to for many years. There's even a joke going around at the Crypto Vigilante in the back end, and it's an inside thing where we quote Amir Taki constantly, and we keep reminding ourselves that we are the darkness. Amir, welcome to the Crypto Vigilante. How are you doing today?
Thanks. Hi, guys. Wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Interesting. Well, my the delivery of my jokes still need to be worked on, but that's not why we're here. I'm not a stand-up comic. We're here to talk about what really matters in crypto, Amir. And you've been someone memes. That... Yes, sir?
Memes. You said what really matters in crypto, the memes.
The memes, 100%.
We are the darkness.
100%. I mean, all the meme coins.
Dark find memes with you guys.
Let's do it.
Good one coming out. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you make sure you send them to us, and maybe we can throw them on this video.
Yeah, brilliant.
Awesome. So you have been someone that has been championing privacy since the early days of Bitcoin. You and your team were part of the creators of Dark Wallet and the Bitcoin implementation Libitcoin. What happened to Libitcoin? What happened to Dark Wallet?
So Libitcoin is still very active. There's like a group of developers who are very diehard there, who believe in the project a lot and are extremely dedicated to them. I have like a lot of admiration for their like focus and single-minded dedication. So in terms of Libitcoin, what they really need now is basically they have done like a lot of very important kind of breakthrough work, which could have like a very big effect and actually big hugely benefit Bitcoin. The problem is Bitcoin Core group has such a stranglehold on the kind of mind share of the Bitcoin community that it's hard for other development teams to kind of come up and compete with them. And so we have this very centralized development. So I'm trying to see now how we can, bring liquidity, some of these liquidity flows into the Libitcoin team so they can actually bring their innovations and their research to market. In terms of DarkFi, DarkFi, we released the alpha version of the software, which we did this crowdfunding for, but then the software went in stasis for many years. And the problem with that was around Dark Wallet, we had like community, and I had a team that was very enthusiastic, and I was kind of inspiring all those people in that kind of development. So then I went away, and development on Dark Wallet stopped. I came back in 2017, and people started going to me, you need to make Dark Wallet. And I started to look, and I saw that in crypto, there was a lot of new cryptography algorithms, like Mimblewimble and ring signatures and, Sigma proofs and Schnorr and everything. And I started to do a long research into all these algorithms. And each time I kind of implemented them, I also implemented Lelantis. Lancers is actually quite good, but the other ones like Ring Signatures and so on, I saw that there was some kind of problem with them, which meant that I wasn't ready to bring a product to market that was like subpar in terms of quality. So that's why, you know, we've really taken our time to kind of come up with a new technical proposal, which is what DarkFi is. So that kind of answers the question of people going, oh, what happened to Dark Wallet? Like, what you said you'd bring it out is like, yeah, like we spent a long time. It's been many years, like more than 4 years in development, not just technical development, but also philosophy, economics, like, you know, in terms of the narrative, you know, the financial aspects, you know, like how do we bring all these elements together to develop something that is comprehensive, and like leverage the most cutting edge, newest knowledge in the market. Now, in terms of Dark Wallet, there's a very big lesson there, which is that my presence being out of the project led to a kind of standstill. So a lot of times in terms of development, we always talk about a bus factor. A bus factor is how many people in your project does it take to get run over to kill the project. So if there's a bus factor of one, that means there's one guy. If he gets run over by a bus or he leaves the project, then the project cannot ever progress anymore. So we did not have a technical bus factor. We had like a very good technical bus factor, since, for example, the core technology was LibBitcoin. There's a still active, very competent team of devs there. The Dark Wallet product team as well, they were also doing most of the work. But where our project did have a kind of centralization point was like around myself in terms of narrative and the promotion of the project. So really now what I'm trying to do with DarkFi is we have a critique, which is a lot of crypto is very oriented around these cults of personality, and the personality is also something that leads to centralization of projects. It actually also kills the community aspect, where if you have a very strong founder, they can overshadow other people in that community who want to come up. So, you know, very much like I want to find a way to bring other people up in the project and put them also in the front. And most importantly, we are trying to not develop a project or some kind of corporation. A lot of the crypto projects now, they're a corporate structure. We're trying to develop something that is post-corporate, which is democratic, which is decentralized, where the entire community are stakeholders, and also we're trying to develop that community into a movement with a philosophy, because a lot of movements fail because of the lack of a strong philosophy and an intellectual culture. So that's what we're trying to foster within DarkFi, as something that, you know, that if you kill the head, the entire project will persevere and continue in the long term.
Okay, so in a nutshell, could you please explain what DarkFi is? You said it's a protocol, right?
Yeah.
Is it a blockchain?
Yeah.
How does it work?
It's not a blockchain. We don't have the blockchain part right now because that's not the like kind of core part, but we are thinking about integrating Casper CBC as a blockchain algorithm. But there will be many blockchains, so each application can run its own blockchain. The blockchains can interoperate through a system of bridges, like what we call cashiers. And we want to make the bridges decentralized. How that will be done from Bitcoin is tricky because if you over collateralize the cashiers, you limit the liquidity to come into the network, where some protocols that use over collateralization have the problem that actually the fee to come into the network ends up being like very high. And it makes it very, like when you look at some of the crazy profit rates that people are making in crypto, you'd have to kind of compete with that to allow over collateralization, so the fees would be very high. So that's one thing we're trying to think about, you know, how to do that decentralized and not centralized. It's a different thing bridging internally between internal blockchains. Actually, it's more of a simpler question. We want to create this decentralized model of many networks and many blockchains. Not like the Polkadot model where there's a single blockchain and everybody has to pay rent to be a part of.
Right.
Which is the crowd loans.
Is this going to be more like a open transactions model?
I don't know what the open transactions model is, but I'd say it's like an ecosystem or a technology stack. And, you know, we support each other, and, you know, we encourage like other communities to come in and work together, because there is a lot of commercial modeling in crypto. For example, Solana is a good example of it, which is the walled garden approach, where you kind of lock in liquidity into your kind of chain or you're into your like kind of ecosystem. And there is this idea in crypto as well that when people fork, that you're deleting value. So, for example, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Ethereum Classic. But actually, we don't see the forks delete value. We think it just creates new value. It allows like expansion of the ecosystem. So, you know, in fact, when we're encouraging this free open model where, you know, people can integrate and with the ecosystem, and the liquidity is like not locked in, it's allowed to flow. We think ultimately that's like a stronger model.
Yeah. So I'm happy that you're seeing it that way, because that's how I'm beginning to see it myself. It's almost like it's important to have these experiments flourish on their own. But at the same time, the economists in me would prefer for people to remain within the same network so that they can leverage off one another's success. So I always find myself like in that tug of war between what you just said and the idea of leveraging off one another's success. You mentioned Casper CBC. So is that Casper as in the development in Ethereum, Casper?
Yeah. So there was two kind of branches of the Ethereum consensus algorithm, Ethereum 2 basically is like the compromise, where they said like, let's just pick the dirty option and just like launch with that. And Casper CBC was like the more kind of purist blockchain approach, which allow between this kind of trade-off between like sliding parameters that you can adjust to get a trade-off between decentralization and scalability, you know. So it's like customizable in that way, and so we're looking at the consensus algorithms now, and that's one that seems kind of interesting to adopt. There's been like a lot of progress in that recently. About proof of work, it really seems that the narrative is shifting against proof of work. So that kind of seems like it's not maybe tenable for a new project.
I mean, I love proof of work. So it's like, I'm so biased for it that it's really, it's for me, sometimes it, you know, proof of stake is just, you know, I would have to really study it. Let's just say that. But yeah, overall at the Crypto Vigilante, we tend to be like more on the proof of work side of things. So, yeah, so your
proof of stake has this like, oligarchy problem.
Yeah.
Which is an issue. And proof of work, can be fairer in some aspects, although there are a few things. Like first you know, you have people, there is this like concentration of specialized hardware that kind of lead to this concentration of power, which is a problem. The other one is the, you know, miners who mine Bitcoin create this selling pressure because they need to like cover costs. But actually, a lot of miners aren't doing that today. They're using sophisticated hedging strategies to avoid dumping Bitcoin. So that critique is maybe less valid now. But it's not a clear cut technical answer. People treat it like a technical question. We're not treating it as a technical question. We're simply saying that, like, in terms of the market, like how the narrative is shifting in the market, the proof of work is like a very big kind of source of contention, it seems, in terms of narrative.
I want to talk to you more about open transactions after this call is over, because that's another like option out there that hasn't been fully like expanded on, but it's just a different type of architecture altogether. But we'll just save that for a conversation. But yeah, so right now, so you're working on zero knowledge proofs. There has been a lot of critique behind zero knowledge proofs. And before this call, you told me that you've been studying Halo Arc, correct? What are your opinions on Halo Arc? I know you actually wrote something on it recently, correct?
Yeah, so I've studied like pretty much all the anonymous crypto algorithms from my team implemented the first version of CoinJoin. I've also implemented Schnorr aggregated signatures and Mimblewimble, you know, back when people were saying Mimblewimble was anonymous. I implemented it and then I realized it's actually not anonymous and it was like false advertisement. I implemented ring signatures. I managed to get 100,000 ring signatures down to like a few seconds. But even that anonymity set, 100,000, is far too low. Monero, I think, I don't know what it uses now. I think it uses like 10 or something. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's, 10 decoys, one real one, so 11.
Yeah,
that's
even much lower than 100,000. I've implemented Lelantis, which is based off of Jens Grof, 1 out of n commitment to zero. And I've also implemented Bulletproofs. I've implemented Sonic, Plunk, Grof 16, which is the algorithm used in Zcash, Halo 1, Halo 2. So I actually think that in terms of the best algorithm, probably is Plunk or FF Plunk, which is like a newer variant of that. It's actually extremely fast. It's very similar to Halo 2. Actually, in terms of ZK, I think like there is a guarding of knowledge among academics where, you know, like when you see technical autistic people, they talk to each other like in this really nerdy way, go, oh, actually the Schnelling point of the Dunbar number, blah, blah. It's like, oh yeah, you don't really need to talk like that. It's like, actually, it's not technical what you're talking about. You're just trying to sound smart. You know, like they do that kind of stuff. when they talk about like social things. And it's kind of like that with ZK. You like look at these papers and you're like, oh fuck, like it's like 50 pages. But like once you know the basic ideas behind it, it's actually very simple and basic. It's just that there's no resources really like teaching them in a good way. And it's especially not for programmers. And the problem is, it's like if you want to write good ZK code, you need to be like a good programmer who knows to write cryptography software, but you also need to be like an algebraist, need to know abstract algebra from mathematics, which, you know, like people are either one of those, but they're not like both. Yeah, so in terms of zero knowledge algorithms, the way that they work, you know, I'm talking about ZK SNARKs now, is that there are two parts to the algorithm. The first part is how you translate a piece of code into a series of mathematical equations, which become represented by like each line of these of these equations that like what we say in force relations, but basically it's just like translating the code that you have into just math formulas, which is just equivalent between the two things. We translate these to polynomial expressions, and then we compress like all these lines of polynomials into like a single line. You don't need to do that, but it makes it much more scalable and faster. We call that process arithmetization. So the arithmetization is used in Halo 2, which is what Zcash is moving over to now from Groff 16, is the same as Planck, the Planck arithmetization. The second part of a zero knowledge algorithm is what's called the polynomial commitment scheme. So polynomial commitment scheme, we told you, remember, you said the arithmetization creates these polynomials, a way of having an having this polynomial which is encrypted. So if I give you this encrypted polynomial, you can see it's an encrypted piece of data, but you can't see what the actual polynomial is itself, this mathematical object. And then you challenging me to open this function at a certain point. And that's what the polynomial commitment scheme is. The polynomial commitment scheme that Halo 2 uses is bulletproofs, which bulletproofs was developed by what was his name? Yeah, so bulletproofs, Jonathan Bootle. He was invented by Jonathan Bootle. So bullet, and originally Jonathan Bootle actually made a paper in 2016, where he was actually mainly talking about the arithmetization part. But he said, oh, and if you wanted to do this without having a trusted setup, you can use this mathematical trick. He just has it at the end of the paper kind of thing, or like in a short section of the paper. But then later, together with Benedict Buns and the other Bitcoin people, like Peter Willey and Gregory Maxwell, they made the bulletproofs paper. That actually came from Jonathan Bootle. But that same paper actually led to Sonic. And Sonic was not using the bulletproofs polynomial commitment scheme, but is using the other one, which is used in Groff 16, which has the trusted setup, but is much faster, and is also what Planck uses. So you can actually see that a lot of these zero knowledge algorithms, there's like a new paper that's published with like a new name for the algorithm, is actually just like pre-existing concepts, maybe like one new idea, but like different things mixed and matched together. So Halo 2 is essentially the arithmetization from Planck plus the polynomial commitment scheme from bulletproofs, whereas Planck itself it uses a different type of polynomial commitment scheme, which has been improved over time. So the current one in Zcash, you know, you do the polynomial commitment scheme and you need this trusted setup, this toxic waste. And that one, you have, before you had to do this ceremony and then that was it. But now the new versions of that is universal and updatable. So what universal means is if you update the contracts or the code that you're making a proof about, you don't need to do another ceremony. And what updatable means is that anybody like me, you, we can add randomness to that data. And as long as one of us is valid, it's completely random. So that's, I think, about one fifth or like five times as fast as the Bulletproof version. However, this idea of trusted setup, it's so toxic, like in terms of crypto, and there's so much fud behind it. That actually, in terms of the market, or like in terms of like what people prefer, Bulletproofs is probably like the correct option, even though it has like less kind of scalability. So Halo 2 is essentially using the Bulletproofs there, and Neuromatization. Actually, I've written a version of Halo 2 in 300 lines of code. Like the entire proving and verifying algorithm. So anybody who says it's too complicated, they're probably just filtered by not being good at math, to be honest. Which is probably going to trigger people that hear that. But honestly, the math it uses is not that complicated. The algorithm itself is not that complicated. It's just really obscure, and like there is not any good resources at all, like how Halo 2 works. I've had to spend months digging through code to like figure things out. So I do think like Halo 2 is probably the best like that we have now, and like all projects should probably just use Halo 2. It's like fast, it's efficient, doesn't have trusted setup, you know, there's no gotchas there. Also, a very interesting property with Halo 2 is the type of elliptic curves they use is not like, you know, Bitcoin have this SEC P256K1 curve, and you know, other projects they use curve 25519. They use a simple curve called a simple normal Edwards curve Weierstrass curve for Halo 2, but it has a very nice property where. So normally in elliptic curves, a curve is like on a graph is defined by its x and y coordinates, the point on the curve. So any point, you need to have an x and a y coordinates. And we call those the field that those x and y coordinates exist in. They're called the base field. And then when we multiply numbers by those points, we call that the scalar field. So they use this trick in Halo 2 where they've created these two elliptic curves where the base field is the scalar field of another curve, but also the base field of that other curve is a scalar field of this original curve. And what that means is you can actually build, you can do elliptic curve operations very fast inside of that ZK circuit. But what you can also do is you can build a ZK verifying circuit inside of that ZK circuit. And so what that means is you get recursion property, which means that, for example, you can make a proof, there's a proof that is valid, and you can do this any arbitrary number of times. So for example, MENA protocol, which has been very poorly executed, the wallet software is very bad, but the idea is solid. Instead of like in Bitcoin where you have the genesis block and each transaction in Bitcoin kind of updates the current state using this state transition function to the next state, what you can do is all you need is the current state of the blockchain plus a 22 kilobyte zero knowledge proof that the current state is valid. The going from the genesis block, applying all these transactions, you arrive at the correct state. So now to sync your node, you don't need to download an entire blockchain and spend like however long trying to index and verify
wow.
all this data. All you need is just like a small proof and the current UTXO set, and you're good to go, basically. You've got like a full node up and running. Yeah, so that's pretty interesting and breakthrough, the recursive proofs. And what I'm interested in as well is so I talked about how now in this Halo 2, they're using Twisted Edwards curves, but there's also other proposals for other types of curves that people can use, like something like Jacobian hyperelliptic curves, which enable like embedded pairings and like very, very complex stuff. Which what's interesting is, so for example, bilinear pairings, or, you know, a different type of group called unknown order groups, for which like the RSA group, you know, like RSA cryptography are good examples. What you can do is you can do membership. You can have a set, and you can, so Merkle tree is an example of what's called an accumulator in cryptography. So if you have a Merkle tree, you can put things in the Merkle tree, and you can prove that things are in the Merkle tree without having to have all of the data. So for example, like with a Merkle tree, you know, I can take the Merkle tree of UTXO outputs in Bitcoin, and I can give you my UTXO plus what's called a proof for that Merkle tree, and then you can see that my UTXO is in the Bitcoin blockchain of unspent UTXOs without you having to search linearly through all the UTXOs, without you having to store all the UTXOs. That's very useful, not just for UTXOs, but for many different things. It's actually how we do anonymous transactions in Zcash and DarkFi and applications. You know, we mint a coin or a credential, and then later we burn it. And when we burn it, we have a condition where we check that, you know, there's some coin in the proof that's in the Merkle tree. We don't reveal what the coin is. We just have the proof of that it's there. So anyway, that's a useful property. But using these new constructs, you can also make a proof that something is not in the Merkle tree. And if you can prove that something's not in the tree or not in the set, then you can also update values in the set. And you can have also hash maps. And as people who do computer science know, if you have a hash map, you can make any arbitrary data structure. And then you can do any complex data structure. You can do very complex smart contracts, and as well, you know, you can leverage like other new techniques that are coming out to enable you to like have these very advanced like anonymous financial markets, anonymous financial applications. DAOs are very interesting. The DAOs, like if you look at like 2 years ago, they were just like a theoretical concept. Nobody really used them. However, we look at the DAOs now, there is like genuine popular engagement with the DAOs, you know, and also interestingly, a lot of women using them, because women typically haven't really been involved in crypto that much. So that's something that I found kind of interesting. But DAOs are part of this post-corporate community model, which allows like new types of crypto organization or crypto organizations, social organization between people, before these like influences from the state or like this like power and capital monopoly can like narrow projects ideologically, like narrow them and say, oh, you have to organize in this particular form. So we're seeing a lot of new emergent forms of organization happening. And this can be bolstered by these anonymity techniques, where we can create anonymous social and political forms of organization, which is very interesting for contentious topics. We're seeing the whole kind of big tech transparent paradigm playing out on the web, and how that censors voices, you know, and stops like, and really like really kind of constrains the political voice to this small liberal elite from, you know, like Silicon Valley, basically, who think in a certain way and think and kind of try to universalize that to the rest of the world when the rest of the world is so different. So that's interesting in terms of DAOs and also in terms of financial markets. You know, I remember when Ethereum was coming out in 2014, they actually asked me to be the lead developer of Ethereum. And I said no, because I couldn't see like what it would be used for. It was very hard back then to imagine the usefulness of things like stablecoins and AMMs or, you know, lending protocols or any of these applications we're seeing emerge now, and all this experimentation, which back then kind of looks like, you know, just I don't know how to say it, but you know, looked just like wishy washy. Didn't look like it would amount to anything. So these kind of primitives mean that we can construct this financial markets, which are actually very useful and can be bridged to like local economic networks in the real world. So a lot of interesting technical leads that kind of exist. And so I think the zero knowledge is kind of the right direction to go, because it is unlocking an entirely new untapped design space of anonymous applications that weren't before previously possible. And so therefore, like, we see this as an ideological mission, and we don't see like DarkFi as like one team or one project, but as a community in which we want to bring in other communities. We want to build those relations, we want to build those economic links, you know, and kind of like empower each other, you know.
Bravo. Thank you so much for doing that, because we really need that. We really need that, because in crypto, we have suffered from the problem of tribalism, which is a problem, because we find like brain draining into different networks. But at the same time, if you take a meta perspective on all this, you actually start realizing that your description is quite accurate. And, you know, as you were talking, the main thing that came to mind was that we are, especially when we're talking about privacy and freedom, we are all working together, whether we realize it or not, because we are all leveraging off one another's research. And what I see happening, Amir, I see you being, you know, re-engaging crypto and being like a very key person in that you are doing a survey of all of the privacy technologies that exist, very similar to what we do at the Crypto Vigilante. And I don't want to give this away to right now, but after this call, me and Amir are going to be talking about a lot of things, because to cross-pollinate ideas is probably the most important thing for us to do, and for us not to get stuck on sunk costs, but rather for us to leverage off one another's efforts. And that's really what I see happening here. Right now, today, we are not going to talk about Pirate Chain, because everything that in regards to Pirate Chain that could be said has been said already. All of the research that you've done with zero knowledge proofs are definitely in line with everything that we see within the development of crypto in general. One aspect of all of this that I think you emphasize cryptography, mathematics, engineering, and where do you see crypto going in the future? Do you see us moving closer together, or is this something that we need to literally take a deliberate stance in making sure that we are not having our efforts divided up even further?
So in terms of how crypto is developing now, if you look at a lot of projects, there is a lot of new, very bland projects that are coming out, and they have this very kind of like white marketing, safe language, and there are like enormous pressures to conform, not only from like coming from without, but from within. So I've actually experienced this myself, where certain routes to power have been blocked off to me because people have gone like, oh, I don't, you know, blah, blah, and, you know, like for political reasons and so on. And then, and so what's happening now is this process of assimilation by the system. A lot of these pressures that exist to conform, they don't actually come from the market itself. They come from this like network of people, you know, like a lot of them in the US who, you know, they get cheap allocation in projects, and they give the projects USD. And, you know, where they get that USD from is from their networks of friends who, you know, talk and act in a certain way. And slowly this, like, I talked about this liberal elite in California as well, who think and act in a certain way and believe that's universal for everyone. And so it's very similar as well with this like conformity pressure in crypto, especially. There is a certain like also among technologists, I see it like a kind of woke culture, but it's not a radical culture. It's like in some ways even like opposed to like radicalness. It's, you know, it's and so so it's important for us to kind of draw a line in that respect, because in nature, any organism every organism has a means of self-defense. Even if it's like a cell that exists, it has a cell wall around it that maintains the integrity of that organism. And so it's important, like as a community that's growing up, you know, like an individuating itself and separating itself off, that it like define who it is and it have that voice and it speak with that sense of conviction and clarity, so that things are able to change and are able to be put forward, you know, in the sense if we want to like actually apply these ideas, if we don't want, you know, these things that we're talking about to end up becoming means of oppression by the surveillance apparatus. So it is important to draw that line and like to clearly say like there are no in-betweens. You know, you're either on the side of the people or you are on the side of power and capital. But it is also a fact that the regulators are coming after us. And they're not just coming for centralized exchanges, but they're also coming for DeFi and privacy protocols. And so what is important is to develop a united voice that we can use to stand together. And I have seen like a lot of Bitcoiners saying, you know, there is Bitcoin and there are shit coins and we are not the same. And I do think that that kind of divisive language
Amir, hello. I think I lost you there, man. I think I lost you, but right when you said divisive language, someone, I guess, doesn't want Amir to speak anymore. It's not me, but I don't know what's going on. I'm waiting on him. I think he's, I think maybe he lost connection somehow. My connection's good. We'll wait around and see. Hey, Amir, how are you? Okay, you're back.
It just now we have dropped my internet.
We have someone else on the chat. Maybe it's you. You came in through another channel. Maybe your other channel's still open.
Yeah, I think it's just like a style session.
Okay, yeah. All right. So do you want to... How do we kick this person out? Let's see if we... Let's kick out the glowy. We'll call it the glowy.
Yeah, kick him out.
Okay, right. There you go. So you were talking about having a united voice.
Yeah, so I was saying the regulators are going to come after us and... Sowing this disunity in the community will make it easier for powers to play divide and conquer techniques. That's use divide and conquer tactics.
And that has been happening already. You know, it's obvious it has been happening. I've been very vocal about it. My team in general has been very vocal about it. In some regards, we disagree with one another as to like what happened with Bitcoin, what happened in Bitcoin during the civil wars, and to some degree we disagree with each other. Like I sided more with the big blockers, the other members of my team, actually the vast majority, sided more with the small blockers. But what we all agree on is that something did happen, right? We tend to blame one another's camps. But it's important to take a step back. And one thing that we find ourselves being united back in is with Monero, with zero knowledge proofs, like implementations like Pirate Chain. We find ourselves being united again because we see the importance of privacy, because privacy is that one weapon, that shield that protects us against tyranny, that gives us for sure a way forward. So yeah, I agree with you. Have you seen that manifested in crypto? Maybe if you have any examples of that in your personal life with Bitcoin, have you seen that divide and conquer techniques actually play out?
I think there's probably some kind of psychological perception management operation underway. If you think about how much fiat liquidity is flowing into crypto, how much Western power is predicated on maintaining basically dominance over global financial flows. And I think Americans and the rest of the world are saying, I'm talking about American people are saying enough, this is only benefiting a certain class of people. The American population is not benefiting from this themselves. They're losing local manufacturing, local jobs, local democracy, to this globalization apparatus, which is enriching a few billionaires. So I think it's not the world versus the US. It's it's Western elites. Or this elite financial system. And if you think about how much that is a threat, crypto, to that system of power, including the surveillance apparatus, you just have to think they're going to be employing all means of co-opting the community, both economic but also psychological and social. I'm pretty sure that's happening already, I certainly know that it's done on a corporate scale. People hire beautiful women to seduce CEOs of large market cap crypto projects, to get information. So it's probably happening by states, if not by the US, certainly by less scrupulous states like Chinese, Russians, whoever.
So are you trying to tell everyone here to be careful with the crypto diggers, that they might be spies? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be careful, really guys. Careful. Honestly, it's every social movement has had this happen. Malcolm X, they, the Black Panthers, the CIA actually spread crack and hard drugs in Black communities to weaken the resolve of that revolutionary movement. That's why the IRA actually kneecaps drug dealers. It's because the state actually uses drugs as one way of like infiltrating activist communities to like weaken them. It's in Ireland, actually, there was with the IRA, what the British Secret Services were doing was actually creating these fake demonic ritual sites in villages all around Northern Ireland during the Troubles, and then like reporting them to news organizations who would like turn up to the scene and they'd see like what looked like there'd been like a satanic ritual. And they did that because it created this atmosphere of like this like art atmosphere where people felt like things had just gone very wrong, you know, like there was like murder around them, now there was God had been lost, there's satanic rituals happening. And actually what the insiders say is that they stopped doing those campaigns after a death had been attributed to those satanic rituals, because these satanic rituals, when they started appearing in the press, started to spawn copycats. But it actually lasted for many years, these satanic rituals, for almost a decade. So that's something that's publicly known. The Secret Services actually did during the Troubles, you know, and they did a lot of very strange stuff. You know, the state is willing to murder people. In the UK, when we had David Kelly come out with the documents, the reasoning for going to war with Iraq, the WMDs, was fabricated by the government. He turned up dead 5 days later in the committing suicide in the forest. He'd slit his own wrists. You know, so it's like, oh yeah, so they're like, you know, like they're willing to kill like a guy that was in the public light who leaked like a few documents when everybody knew it was a lie, essentially. You know, it's like, what are they like? Of course they're gonna try and infiltrate and crack down on crypto. They're already like drafting laws, like if you look at them are crazy, because it's like how can you say that somebody who writes a DeFi protocol, you know, or a piece of software, like let's say a privacy software. I write a privacy software that enables someone else to do something, but it's not me. I'm not running a service. I've just written software. I've put the software out. How can you say that I am liable? You know, like we had this conversation in the 90s with PGP. PGP, right. They printed the code in a book. And they sold the book and they said, oh, the book is protected under the First Amendment. First Amendment guarantees your right to free speech. But that's not actually true, because your speech is limited. Like, and if I say something that incites someone to go commit violence, then I'm partly responsible for that speech. So, you know, they're trying to insinuate now that the people who create software and put this software out there are liable for the actions of the people who use the software. So it's very insidious encroachment on people's rights. It's also in lockstep with the architecture of this surveillance apparatus, these new COVID passports, which contain all of your details. You know, I don't know if people know, but in Germany, in Berlin, whenever you go to a restaurant, you have to write your name of every single person sitting at a table on a form, your telephone number, your address where you're staying. It's like that info is shared with every single place, every single establishment that you go to. When you scan the QR code, it has all your details publicly visible to anybody who can scan that code. This is essentially a war on society. It's like the system has kind of run out of solutions to resolve the incoming crisis. And so they're more and more resorting to authoritarian and totalitarian techniques, which is a type of mega machine apparatus that surround and entomb and encase society. And, you know, you're free to, you know, consume entertainment or pornography, or, you know, your job is consuming, in fact. That's what your job is. That's why UBI is essentially, they're paying people to consume. That's like people's job. And anybody who stand up for that establishment and want to weaken or corrupt crypto and what crypto represent is an enemy of the people, because crypto is it's so strong as a technology that it cannot be stopped. Like, I'm not saying that in an objective, factual way. If like humanity got nuked and we returned back to the Stone Ages and we lost most of our technology, yeah, crypto would not, probably not, you know, in its current state maintained. But you know, it will eventually, it will come back around, you know, in the same way we had the Dark Ages. We lost all the knowledge of ancient Greek civilization, but then we had the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was Western scientists going to Constantinople or Istanbul and finding the old books that had been translated from Greek to Arabic, and then were translated by those people back from Arabic into Latin. All the old science and technology, somehow this knowledge in aggregate that has been added to human society will make its way into the future. So, you know, trying to put limits on an idea historically has not been able to work. You know, the movie V for Vendetta, the main character, he says, beneath this mask is more than flesh. Beneath this mask is an idea, and ideas are bulletproof. What he's saying is essentially represent the will of crypto, which is we have powerful ideas. The ideas are unstoppable. And so, you know, in history, breakthrough technological progress has not been able to be stopped by naysayers, people in political power, compromises with political power. It led to radical social divergence or a break the current regime of power and capital, like the printing press. People wanted to stop the printing press. I'm saying crypto is here. And essentially, if you're advocating for weakening cryptography because you want to buy favor from regulators, you know, so that you can allow cryptography to, or cryptocurrency to, you know, win some kind of advantage, you're really confused, you know, or you're corrupted by some other kind of influence that's there. And a lot of these people who, as I said, like, there's this pressure to conform on projects. There's a network of, you know, funders and people in Silicon Valley connected to big tech. They're corrupted. And, you know, they like to say that they're like doing it for social good or whatever, but they're simply corrupt. They live in the first world. You know, they're like, oh, you know, this technology needs to be hampered because of first world concerns. They always bring up like think of mass adoption. And what they mean is like, think of like first world consumers. This is like technology for the people. It's not for rich people in your like enclaves. So crypto is coming, and you know, those people are going to have to adapt and accept the new order that's coming. And that's simply the reality of it all. So what I say to everybody else is, you know, let's innovate. Let's push this as far as we can, because the rewards are enormous. The actual outcome can lead us to create something, because the way things are going, the monopolization of power and capital is reaching extreme levels, and like nobody knows exactly where it's going to stop or where it's going to break. You know, it's too complex. There's like too many factors that are building up, and you know, like the tendency is to complex systems like fuel, like forest debris that is built up for a decade and has not been allowed to burn out, becomes a tinderbox where a single match can set everything aflame in an instant. And the more that the debris or the complexity or the kind of lack of like resolution is allowed to build up, the bigger that the forest fire is going to be, the more intense it's going to be. So that is the future that we're heading to. But for some reason, like, this segment of, or there's like trying to infiltrate crypto or trying to steer crypto, seems to be in denial about that reality. But it's a reality that's felt by everybody. Everybody kind of instinctively feels it, and you see it reflected in all the movies, especially all the Netflix sci-fi movies, where there's a constant like brooding, you know, constant tension building atmosphere, where and often like some kind of apocalypse scenario plays out. So the real question is like is not like for now the, you know, like some old TradFi, you know, old power system we want to have their support. Question is like the future, like, you know, like what's our planning there. And I talked about this conformity on projects. And actually, if you look at what the market actually desires, what the market finds interesting, the market actually desires this. It desires projects that are like fresh and like bringing something that's like dynamic and intense and actually real. So nobody's like completely catering for that yet. Nobody's actually bringing that innovation. And I kind of remember like in 20 with the early days of Silk Road, when I went once to this party at a friend's house, and there was a guy in Malay who didn't know who I was, such as a random guy, and he was going, "Hey, have you heard of this website, Silk Road?" You know, and it was like, it was something that captured people's attention because it was something that was genuinely interesting, genuinely subversive. You know, so I think people, if we look at like all the like things, like for example, there was like Occupy, and there's been, you know, all these movements over the last few years. You know, people is waiting for something, and they like, and it's there. Like people see, but they don't know what yet. Like nobody see like what's, how do we resolve these things, or like what's the thing that we do, and you know, the the Soviet Union. They had the last days of the Soviet Union. They had this situation where people were watching, like they were watching the television. And the television was like describing the, you know, the Soviet state. It's like so great, and the economy is spectacular, and like new breakthroughs were being made, and so on. But like people in their daily lives, they were like looking around them, and they were seeing that it was all a lie. That essentially, that the economy was breaking down around them. They could see that it was happening, but people like were not able to visualize like an exit. They weren't able to visualize what that new system would be like. And so what they kept doing is they just kept operating the same routine way in their daily lives. And I'm not saying we live under the Soviet Union, like our system is very different, but essentially we live in a very similar kind of hyper reality today, where, you know, like we can see around us, the economy is clearly failing. You know, like in the 50s, people used to be able to work on minimum wage for 2 years and afford to buy a house. We can clearly see that the state has become too powerful with this surveillance apparatus, which essentially is like a war on society, a type of society side. And we can see the oligarchy that's rising up and all of these things is getting ever more powerful. The QE, the money printing, they keep printing record amounts of credit to push out into the economy. They're like, this credit is going to go into productive sectors of the economy, is going to allow the economy to grow. But the credit simply goes into the hands of speculators who play zero-sum games. It goes into asset purchases like real estate. So, you know, our parents' generation, they keep buying more and more houses. They get cheap credit. They borrow credit. They don't even know why they want to borrow credit. They're like, oh, let's buy more houses. And nobody can afford to buy a house. You know, it's not a good situation. So we have very powerful means at our disposal, the technology, this technological means. And so, you know, like we should use that power for something. We should employ that power because, you know, we have the ability to change things on a big scale.
So you mentioned Monero a little bit ago, and you said that you rather focus on ZK Snarks right now and the development of ZK Snarks. Have you been looking in? You said you before this call, you also told me that you've been looking into Lelantis and the other developments in Monero that the name escapes me at this moment. What are your thoughts on these developments, and where do you see? Do you see Monero ever going into ZK Snarks? Where do you foresee for Monero in the future?
I like the Monero community a lot. But Monero, they really need to adapt. But actually, the Seraphim and Lelantis and the... that is actually developed by... Zcoin or Firo project, FIRO, by their cryptographer Aram Jingavayan. And that actually originally came from Jens Graf, 1 out of N commitment to zero. So that's a very good zero knowledge scheme. It has a very large anonymity set. Like Monero is 11. I think that is like hundreds of thousands or something huge. So that would be a very good upgrade. But Monero chose not to do that upgrade because I think a multi-sig or something like that. So I really think Monero needs to kind of adapt. The reason why I went the way of zero knowledge as opposed to Lelantis is because Lelantis is built for payments from A to B. Whereas we want to do more complex type of financial and political kind of applications. So that's why zero knowledge is more a generic toolkit.
Okay. So, Amir, I have so many questions for you that I think we could be here like 10 hours. I definitely want to have you back, hopefully in the near future. To talk, to get more into detail of the technology, because today you gave us pretty much an awesome lecture from a meta perspective of a survey of everything that regards privacy coins and the latest innovations regarding privacy protocols. How important is privacy? How important is privacy? Because that's my first question for you right now. And then the second question that I have is, do you think Bitcoin protocol privacy is enough?
So a lot of people see often privacy as, or anonymity as like a defensive means where like the individual can like protect themselves against state interference. I actually see it like, as a kind of building block that we can create parallel societies. And the important part about building a parallel society is they are typically in history what nurture revolutionary movements against totalitarianism and like for like a kind of people's democracy. And so these kind of parallel organizations or parallel societies that we create can from the actual seed, like in the seed of how they're built, contain like the code of resistance within them. They're like automatically built in such a way that they always resist like totalitarian control. And these organizations actually are very fundamental building blocks, because it's like when recently we had the when Trump left power, the people, what's it called? They went into the White House, or what was that called? The protesters. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, supposedly they went in. Yeah, I mean, to me that was all a psyop. Just
yeah, people said that they were going like, oh, it's horrific, a coup. I actually thought it was funny. I was like, oh, cool, like, you know, well done, like.
That's not a coup. I mean, a real coup is a bloody endeavor. This was, come on in, and here are the photographers. You know, it was,
But it was interesting because you saw like all these like very different people, and then like they'd like gone into the, I don't know where it was, like the White House, and then they got there and they're like expecting to like overthrow power, but then they got there and it was just like, it was empty rooms. They were like, oh, there's nobody there, actually. So it's like they didn't actually find power in the White House. So that's why I'm talking now about parallel societies as being the seed of a new revolutionary society. Is like, if we want to, like, power is all around us. You know, if we want to reconfigure those social relations, it's not going to be found in a place, you know. So that's why I see the importance of anonymity in cryptography. And the crypto-anarchists, their idea was to create these online zones in cyberspace, which would be impenetrable by power and capital monopolies. Their idea was to, they would allow like marginalized communities to like find a voice, like communities that typically didn't have a voice. And that's interesting because also the agorists, they believe in using free market economics, or what they call counter economics, as a form of activism, or like a form of revolutionary action.
Yes.
Where we can like use markets to build our own base of economic power that is outside of the typical, you know, whole kind of system that we live in. So it's very interesting, the modern breakthroughs in ZK and cryptography, which allows to construct these very sophisticated like online parallel societies, which could enable new forms of human organization to flourish, which are beyond the state sanctioned hierarchical models, which require domination.
It's such a mind fuck, right? Because I, you know, whenever I look at a protest, you know, what you said is exactly what I been meditating on recently, which is, you look at a protest, where is the power? I mean, they're literally, it's all just a giant, like, systemic brainwashing, because all there really is a bunch of guys wearing, with guns, threatening people. But like you said, if you were to really go into these buildings, they're just empty buildings. There really isn't anything. So it's wild to me to see how it's all just a giant illusion. Like, this whole power thing is just a giant illusion, where it just comes down to a group of people pointing guns at another group of people. And I know you lived this firsthand, right? In the Middle East recently.
Yeah, the American Revolution, I heard in the beginning, there were only a very small group of revolutionaries who, in fact, were not supported by the population. The population did not, were like, oh, we're perfectly happy with British rule. And it was only after the British counter-reacted with extreme force that it radicalized the entire population, that people saw how oppressive the British presence was, that people started to turn over to the side of the rebels. And the same thing actually happened in Ireland with the British colonization, where the original, with the independence of Ireland, where originally a lot of the Irish people didn't support rebellion against England. They thought maybe there's a few small issues, that should be worked out. But it was only after the advocates of this movement who advocated for very simple rights that the British reacted so harshly against them that people ended up turning against the British and getting radicalized and seeing more in line with their point of view. The same thing actually happened with the Kurdish movement as well. In the 90s, the Kurdish is actually one of the oldest languages in the world. In the 80s, it was on the verge of being wiped out completely. It was about to disappear. The PKK actually started as a movement, which the Turkish state reacted so harshly that it actually, a lot of people started rallying to their cause. Originally, the main things that people were talking about were, we just want to be able to have lessons educate in our schools. We want to have schools in our area, be allowed to have schools in our areas where people can be taught in our own language. And the state was like, no, the Turkish state, which is very centralized, said, no, everything has to be done in Turkish. So that was simply the main kind of goal that people were advocating for. And actually, because the state reacted so harshly against that, and it led to this war and stuff, Kurdish now has the Kurdish region, people are a lot more into their identity. It's stronger than ever. So it's experiencing a big revival. So, but yeah, they have this conflict where they were fighting for independence. They were kind of a nationalist organization and in the 90s, and it really spiraled out of control. It went really crazy. Like tens of thousands of people on both sides died, and when their leader Öcalan, he went to prison, he started to he wrote this. He actually is the sole prisoner on an island in South Turkey, which is guarded by 10,000 soldiers, in the middle of the ocean. They have this island, Alcatraz. It has one prisoner, which is the leader of the PKK. He's guarded by 10,000 soldiers, and he wasn't allowed to communicate anything outside of his prison. But then Turkey wanted to join the EU. So to join the EU, they were going to execute this guy, but instead they had to give him a trial, a fair trial. And his part of his trial was to be able to appeal to the European Court of Justice. Is when he appealed to the European Court of Justice, his actual defense to the European Court of Justice were three books that he smuggled out, which is called Manifesto for a Democratic Civilization. And the books, three have been translated to English, very good books. And in the books, he talks about how the old approach that they used was wrong, where they were fighting to have their own state. Because the problem with the Middle East is that people in the Middle East, it's a very old society. There are like really, really old religions there, like Gnostics. You know, there's like a religion there where they worship Lucifer, essentially. They're like they, in that religion, they like teach the angel that refused to bow down before God. He was sent to Earth by God himself to protect the humans. Really, lots of different tribes, lots of different loyalties. It's very like kind of decentralized. You know, the Middle East also they don't have banks at all, really, because people really distrust the banks. They also distrust the government. So they have these hawala networks where people like move money around. So the Middle East is like a very kind of decentralized society, and many different ethnic groups have been living side by side for like millenniums, for like long periods of time. And it's only in the last 100 years we've had all these problems with like ethnic cleansing and genocide and all this shit. And what Ocalan says is that the issue is the nation state. It's like the nation state create all these problems because there are these entities. If you look at for example, the border of Syria, it's a straight line on a map. There's nothing organic about that. And it cuts like right through different groups. And in fact, the Kurds themselves, Winston Churchill, he actually said like he's in favor of gassing them because they're unruly mountain tribes. And the Kurds were deliberately divided into four separate states as a way of weakening them. And so what it's done is it create this situation where like one part of the Kurdish nation is part of the Turkish nation state. The Turkish nation state is very afraid of them breaking off. And so the Turkish state becomes very authoritarian and uses like a lot of domination and military and surveillance and automated weaponry to force those people to remain part of that political entity. But it's not just the Kurds, it's everywhere in the Middle East, absolutely everywhere. And so Ocalan was saying like, okay, like the nation state is the problem, and like fighting for independence is not the solution. And actually what the struggle should be about is fighting for de facto autonomy. And so his books actually like end up laying out strategy. And he also in the third book, he make a very good critique of the anarchist movement, why the anarchist movement failed. You know, and he says that the anarchist movement failed to have like a coherent vision of society that it would like struggle for, and also failed to have like a systematic strategy about how it would like end up realizing that vision. And we kind of see that today with all these, like, as you mentioned, protest and activist movements, which are all of them actively controlled or like shaped. You know, like in England, we have like Tavistock Institute, which is a psychology organization, which, you know, does all this like perception management, uses these techniques, you know, to shape protest movements. And that really also came out of like the 60s counterculture movement, where everybody like started taking acid and going like, oh, I reject politics, man, like I'm an individual. Like, so we actually need to like evolve our thinking beyond that. And we kind of see that with crypto now, where everybody's like doing their own thing, but there's a lot of like infighting, but there's like very little like it's like the discussion we need to elevate is the discussion about like, okay, like, you know, like what is our philosophy? Like what is our vision of society? Like how do we like, end up like realizing that, like what are the steps to put in place, you know, that's absolutely key and critical. You know, like people always talk about Israel and Palestine. They always go like, oh, should there be like one nation state, or should there be two nation states? But like nobody ever asks the question, what about no nation state? Like what kind of bad political system is this where you have groups of people in society fighting for singular control over political power? there's a very bad political system. You know, there's not a political system that is of the people. There's a political system that is of a group of elites, you know. And so that is that kind of thinking is where it's all essentially gone wrong. It's like, and now the kind of surveillance apparatus that is being created is part of that mechanism of control of like having like a system of state where everybody exists in this like giant like kind of mega machine where we're in an apparatus. The CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies that they're trying to bring in, you know, it's another means of control, of centralization of the entire financial apparatus into a single central bank. It's a process that's been going on in Europe for many years. In England, we only have 5 high street banks. Essentially, what they want to have is that everybody has just their current account directly on the website of the central bank. You know, so, and they just give you credits in there, and the UBI is just like their airdrop to incentivize people. You know, the thing with China as well, the social credit scoring, the social credit scoring system, where they give incentives for people to behave a certain way, you know, to manage society through positive reinforcement or even sometimes negative reinforcement. That's actually been an inspiration for Western states. Actually, they want to copy that model. And so that's what the CBDCs is about. It's about creating a form of social credit scoring in the West. So we're very much like heading down this route. And so that's why I think also the lessons of Rojava, of Ocalan, I recommend people to read his books on political philosophy, Manifesto for a Democratic Civilization. I think it's very important that we're able to actually foster this political philosophy and this vision and start to create this ecosystem of products where we leverage the best in technical knowledge that we have as a means of carving out spaces of freedom, which are absolutely going to be necessary and are necessary because of the surveillance architecture that's being erected, which wants to encase and entrap society.
Yeah, I'm just mind boggled by how deep the brainwashing goes, right? Because the first thing that comes to mind is, well, and I think this is the knee-jerk reaction that everyone has, is how, okay, we let's say we get rid of government, how do we then organize? And if there's that fear of the unknown that people tend to just say, well, the first thing is like we need to create our own independent government. And this is what you hear a lot of people. This is the mainstream understanding of what changing our civilization would entail, is to recreate government in another way. And then you have this understanding that keeps coming back, which is, and I hear it a lot amongst anarchist circles, which is like, well, really, you have to change the heart. You have to change people from within. There will always be people that desire power. This is a struggle of that we have as human beings, and it's something that will always be something that we cannot get away from. And I feel like that's almost, in a sense, almost like a defeatist answer, because it takes something where we could have solutions, but it almost gives us like the only alternative is then a more spiritual, psychological approach, which would require changing the individual from within. Well, how about if we just embrace the individual as human persons are, and hack the incentive structure of human beings? And that's really what I think happened with Bitcoin, in that the incentive structure, incentive to self-preservation was hacked, where now humanity knows from the mining of the Genesis block that we can do without the central banks, that we can have monetary systems that are independent, that are decentralized, that are censorship resistant. So there are ways for us to organize. And so as I'm talking to you, I feel the need to tell this to my audience, is that my stance on these things are constantly evolving. I cannot, as an individual, say that I am a static entity of that sees the world as is. I'm constantly learning from everyone, and I challenge everyone to learn. We'll definitely have the books you recommended on in the description below. The main question that I have for you is, we need a system of dispute resolution that competes with the dispute resolution system of government law. And that is one aspect of crypto that really we're very much at the beginning of. And privacy is definitely a prerequisite for this. Smart contracts built on privacy protocols are, in my opinion, are the way. But as we stand right now, it seems as if we have only, unfortunately, and this is, being very vulnerable here in this conversation, letting you know, like, where I see things at this present moment, and I could be wrong, is that I only see at this moment government law as like when shit hits the fan, as the only way to really resolve disputes amongst people, because we don't have these cryptographic alternatives. What are your thoughts on this, Amir?
So all throughout history, there's been this conflict between the civilization and the nation of the people. And a lot of knowledge, a lot of what we know, definitions have been shaped by power and the civilization. In fact, if you actually look at the first civilizations that emerged in ancient Mesopotamia, for example, Sumeria and the others, that was a time when there was a flourishing of many different civilization types. And it was the Assyrian Empire, which was a military dictatorship, which defeated the other flourishing empires and established a hegemony that ended up writing the history of what civilization is and what civilization should be. And if you look at civilization on Wikipedia, I encourage people to look at the actual definition of civilization, read it. I'll just read out a small quote from it, which it says, civilizations are organized in densely populated settlements divided into hierarchical social classes with a ruling elite and subordinate urban and rural population. Civilization concentrates power, extending human control over the rest of nature, including over other human beings. Civilization is associated with centralization, domestication of plants and animals, specialization of labor, ideologies of progress and supremacism, monumental architecture, taxation, dependence upon farming and expansionism. So when you talk about law, when we talk about science, for example, science, you know, like we have this view of science, which is objective. The universe is this system of clockwork that operates according to rules, which, you know, in more recent years has started to become challenged, which, you know, we started to move away from. If you go, for example, 100 years ago, terms like central planning or command and control used to be very fashionable. Now it's more fashionable to talk about, you know, butterfly effect or tipping points. And in terms of law, you know, we typically think of law as systems of rules which are like enforced, you know, rules and guidelines. But, you know, there are other forms of law that existed throughout history. There was tribal law. You know, there is the concept of like, what is lawful in society? You know, law as something that is not judged by a state, but is something that the people and exists as a kind of morality in society, as a kind of codified. For example, the Druids in Ireland, they used to have a legal code which could not be written down, was only relayed through speech to through other people. So it's important when we think about law that we don't fall into the trap of falling into the mentality of the system of state and its own power, which has been able to write history in such a way that is beneficial to itself and to its existence. So in terms of crypto, and you're talking about these spiritual hippies who are like, and I've encountered them a lot, like people who like, I'm like, why are you doing this protest? Or like, why are you doing this thing? And they are, it's for like raising awareness. And it's like, okay, well, we all know what is happening. Like, what is raising the awareness actually going to do? Like, or what is the point of like talking about, you know, philosophy if it doesn't give us power to change things, or it doesn't, you know, push us into action? So ideas are important, like concepts and paradigms and narratives. Like, you know, they are what influence human will and human action. But human will and human action is what kind of shapes history. So it's important that when we talk about ideas and when we talk about systems, that they're not isolated from each other. We're thinking like, what are the ideas that are embodied in these systems? What are these systems representing? Which is what you were getting at when you talked about law, concepts of law, which is interesting because there is this discussion in crypto at the moment about immutability. So for a long time, the concept of immutability has been one that it says that the regulators are unable to change the blockchain because it's immutable. However, immutability is a technical programming concept. It's not a social concept. No social reality is immutable. And even Satoshi himself said he said in his white paper, one CPU, one vote. He was essentially saying that, you know, Bitcoin is a type of democracy. Like, we, the people, have the power. But I think it's, and he also said that Bitcoin is a form of P2P money that cannot be controlled by governments and central banks. What he was saying is that the power over Bitcoin is not with governments or central banks, but it's with people. So that's kind of the reality that we have to like get back to and realize. And there is a liberal view, and this is the view of the system, which is that people are pre-political, like that our desires and wants, they exist from birth and they cannot be changed, and the people cannot change. And the role of institutions is simply to negotiate between power. And, you know, and it's part of the view that politics is defined by power. I kind of disagree with this view. I think politics is everything to do with what is concerned with, you know, the needs of society, such as security, well-being, freedom, and we constantly do politics in our daily lives. So when we think about this, you know, the other view in which is in democratic theory is this expansionist view, which is when people engage in politics, what they're essentially doing is that they're individuating themselves through that process of like engaging in public life with other people, that you develop your sense of self. You are able to, you know, like, for example, you can empathize with people, you can reach consensus, you can negotiate. And even if you can't negotiate, you can at least understand, like, you know, like, what are their concerns, you know. And so this process is healthy. And the the goal of politics is to multiply public spaces, and that by designing our systems in a good way, like designing our systems in a right way, it can actually lead to an increase in the type of values that we want to see in society. It can actually lead to society becoming stronger. And when we talk about questions of like power and capital monopolies, we talk about the state, we talk about central banks. What we are essentially talking about is this dichotomy between this system of state civilization and the kind of democratic nation, or whatever you want to call it, the people, and which is actually the society itself. And the goal, I think, of our action inside of all the work that we're doing should be to strengthen society. It's to strengthen the ability of society itself to organize, to meet its needs, to secure its freedom. The way that we design our systems can lead to an increase in those values. At the same time, it's also important that as technologists who are developing these systems, that we're also engaging with society. We're engaging with the kind of struggles or the kind of questions that exist there, so we understand better how to develop our kind of institutions or systems, so they better serve the needs of the people, basically. And I see this very big contradiction inside of, for example, a lot of technical projects, like, for example, Ethereum, which is this kind of transhumanist human social engineering perspective, which is and for me, it's like, it's completely connected to the system itself. It's like, I see it as an extension of the system. Maybe they talk about decentralization, you know, they talk about like how it's like more nicer because it uses blockchain, but essentially, and we see this divide now in crypto. Like I saw it's being characterized as solarpunk versus lunapunk, the lunapunk being the crypto anarchy agorist persuasion, which is about like empowering people or groups of people, like with this kind of like what I was talking about, like this emergent seeds of like post corporate governance structures that are emerging in DeFi, and about how we build the tools to make that form of organization stronger. The other type is like the type where it's like, how do we, and you can, for example, look at the ETHCC talk by Kleros, where Federico says, he talks about the panopticon, and he says Foucault got the panopticon wrong, because the panopticon was good because everybody can be surveilling everybody, the prisoners, that it would be like a decentralized form of surveillance, and therefore it would be a good thing. And that kind of and the panopticon actually is something that came out of the English movement, which is to do with like the factory education system, the garden cities movement, which inspired the Soviet Union, where they started to like build these giant mega cities, which were like completely centrally planned. You know, also suburbanism, you have these monstrous giant like centrally planned cities. So that kind of logic about human social engineering you know, like a classic is what I call like the mega machine. You know, it's like a classic example is the pyramids. It's like is some huge mega structure which was built to serve a king, which had to be built using like slave labor and hierarchy. It's not about equipping society itself with the tools that it needs, you know. So I think that kind of thinking is very dangerous, because it's like it's actually disconnected from the values of society. It actually becomes a new means of oppression. And if we're not careful, you know, blockchain and immutability can become new forms of domination and oppression. For example, I saw a project which was about decentralized social credit scoring, you know, decentralized credit scoring, you know, like to get credit to borrow money, but essentially is like, you know, can become a version of the Chinese system, but like decentralized. And when it's decentralized, it becomes harder to like fight against that, because you no longer know where the center of power actually is. So those of us are of this, and it's funny, because a lot of those people in the ETH community, I was just at LizCon in Lisbon, they characterize themselves as solarpunks. They call themselves solarpunks. It's funny, because the sun itself is a symbol of monotheism. It's a symbol of hierarchical domination. The original king in Sumeria, Shamash, who was the sun god, was essentially a policeman of the sky who enforced the divine rules on all the other gods, riding around in his divine chariot. So the sun is a hot static object in the sky. The moon is a symbol of the night. It's dynamic. It has phases. It cycles in and out. It's to do with like everything that is primordial. That is like to do with like emergent life. To do with the forest. Whereas the sun is a symbol of the desert, and early Semitic tribes.
Amir, real quick, like personally, me, I've been telling people to embrace both. My team gets pissed off when I say that, because they're all like lunar punks, I guess you would call them. Like, they're all just like you. They're completely privacy first, privacy first, privacy first. We need to get money down right. It needs to be fungible at the protocol level, anonymity. This is what we need. We need to build a parallel world, a parallel society that starts with doing money right from the get-go. And I've been the only one that has actually played with this idea of everything you just mentioned, you know, working within the system as it is. You know, I'm the only one in our crew that has always been like, we need to play with this. I've always used the analogy of light and darkness. And I've always gave the notion that what's happening, it's almost a pincer attack against the state. Whereas you have people building privacy protocols, and you have people building more transparent protocols that aim to compete with the status system that exists. So, again, I'm the only one in my team that has this perspective, and it's almost like it's almost like as if I have two brains within me that are constantly in dialogue with each other, right? Like, when I hear you talking, when I hear you say, really makes me reconsider everything that I've thought about the solar aspect of things, right, that you just mentioned. And I think that what really made me question everything that you said was the fact that you emphasized the fact that there has been other ways to resolve disputes, other ways to organize beyond that which we have inherited from these monopolies of violence, right? These centralized states. And it's almost like within me, as I'm hearing you talk, I'm realizing that I myself have been victim of that programming, of that programming that locks you into thinking that there is only one way to organize in society, which would be something similar to that of what we have inherited from nation states. And what you're telling me is that, no, that throughout history, we have organized ourselves differently. So this conversation has been very fruitful to me. I hope it's been very fruitful to everyone watching. On the note of civilization, I love the fact that you read the Webster Dictionary definition of it, because it at its core is violence. At its core is oppression. At its core is hierarchical. At its core, the definition you read emphasizes that there's a ruler and someone being ruled. And which is interesting to me, because in the Austrian theory, the definition for civilization of Ludwig von Mises is one that has to do with voluntarism. It's the knowledge that we can produce more by cooperating, which leads to cooperation and ultimately to civilization. So it's the idea that by working together, by being in communion with each other, we yield more than just by working by ourselves. So it's pretty much what you said, literally echoes what almost every libertarian has been saying. And it's this realization that cooperation yields more. And the Austrian economists would then keep going and would extrapolate on that idea and would say that cooperation results in the division of labor that allows for increasing specialization, right? Which is like, not everyone can be a developer. Not everyone can be a farmer. We all, you know, the labor is specialized, right? There's a division of labor. Yeah. And in this voluntary order, there is a bottom-up coordination through spontaneous order where we have the emergence of a real economy. And to me, this conversation has been so insightful. I don't want it to stop because I'm learning so much from you. Definitely all of the every source that you've mentioned, we're going to put it in the description below. When I got into Bitcoin, and this is something that I really want to ask you. When I got into Bitcoin, I knew from the get-go that Bitcoin was not a privacy protocol. And the reason why I knew that in large part was due to your work with Libitcoin and your work with Dark Wallet. Because I thought to myself, well, if Cody Wilson and Amir Taki are working on increasing privacy within the Bitcoin protocol, then it means that Bitcoin was not created to be a privacy coin. And the moment Monero came out, I fell in love with the idea of starting from scratch and doing things right with a protocol that is private by default. And so then I started thinking, I was like, and this is how I developed into a solar punk, right? In my thoughts, I started thinking, well, if Satoshi did not give us a privacy protocol that was, you know, private by default, and he gave us something that was pseudonymous, why did he do that? Why did Satoshi give us something that was pseudonymous, something that allows for this, like you said, that description of what the Ethereum guy said, that surveillance, right? Which is a term that people have been tossing around, which is not surveillance where there's someone, a panopticon, but rather where we all can look into each other. And so then my idea was then Bitcoin must be a truth machine. Bitcoin must have been created as a way to keep the assholes that are in power accountable, right? Because that's the one thing that they don't want, is to be kept accountable. So then my question was, if that's really what Bitcoin was really created for, because we've always had the, you know, Satoshi could have created a privacy coin. Satoshi could have created Pirate Chain, could have created Monero, but he created something else. He created something that was not private by default. Does that mean that Bitcoin was created as a machine for for accountability? Because I still have this question, Amir, and it's this very sincere question that I have, which is, if all we have is privacy coins, then all the only option then there is still no way to actually get rid of these, of this monopoly of violence. All we can do, in a sense, is to hide from them and create a parallel economy that, in an agorist way, starves the beast, per se. But there, I think that there still needs to be some sort of market-driven incentive structure. And I found Bitcoin's proof of work to be the way that does that, that competes with this technocratic elite, that competes with Silicon Valley. And that, to me, was Bitcoin. Like, Bitcoin has always been that which has the potential for every entrepreneur to use the Bitcoin miners as the back end of their business, so that they're able to, in a sense, so that Bitcoin miners, in a decentralized and competitive way, can literally compete with big tech. And so that's kind of like why I still have this solar punk perspective. And I would love to hear your comment on everything I just told you.
The von Mises quote is very nice. I'm going to use that. The Austrian economists had very good analysis that was accurate in many ways. The problem, they had a very good analysis, which, you know, now is a bit dated and needs updating. But that's not to kind of disparage their work in any way. You know, it's the benefit of hindsight that we have now. But the kind of trap that I think that they fell into was that they fell into this trap of logic and like deductivism, when we know that like social systems are a lot more messy than that. So we were discussing about this immutability aspect, where you can't describe like a blockchain as immutable, because it's to a large part controlled by the community that runs it. And actually, it's actually the community that defines the value of that token, you know, because if there's no community, the token is worthless. So we're seeing this shift now in crypto, where the importance of community is being recognized and kind of emphasized. And so when I was talking about solarpunk and lunapunk is or that tendency, that cypherpunk tendency, in the same way that, you know, I'm saying that state civilization has hijacked science, has like twisted, like, you know, like what the agenda of science is, you know, like the, for example, like how science develops, you know, it can develop in many ways, but in particular how money is put into science will shape how it's developed. And it's very, and I'm not saying that, so it's not to say that science is bad, but it's to say that this religion of scientism, which says that science is completely objective. And so when power uses science, as they often do, for example, objective journalism, you know, they pretend like what they're saying is unbiased, when in fact it's a lot of the time serving an agenda. A lot of these objective forms of knowledge actually end up serving some kind of power apparatus. So it's not to say that we should not use those techniques. In fact, we should use those techniques, as often they're techniques of power. But it's like we have to also deconstruct the techniques to reconfigure them in such a way that they serve the cause of freedom. And so my critique of Ethereum is not that incentive engineering is bad, but it's that the panopticon is bad. It's that decentralized surveillance is bad. The credit scoring systems can become very bad. And so people who are obsessed with creating a completely transparent system where everybody is managed by an algorithm, that is also something that can be oppressive. And so our goal is to like token engineering and incentive mechanism design is the heart of Bitcoin. Like how the miners are incentivized to secure the network, you know, how the whole system works, you know, the way the proof of stake, those all incentive engineering, those techniques are incredibly powerful. I'm saying we should leverage those techniques for freedom. So in some ways, like when we talk about logos and chaos, you know, chaos encompasses everything. Chaos is primordial. Logos is inside of chaos. You know, logos is like a small part of our reality in the same way that we have first nature and second nature. You know, there is like the material reality of what we live in, what we can see, what we can touch, what we can interact with. There's also the reality that's like constructed by humans, which is cultural, which is symbolic, you know, which is constructed. And the interesting thing about cryptography and code is we're not manipulating physical matter. It's actually people that are engaging with these like systems, these incentive systems that we create. So that body of social knowledge play a huge part in the systems that we construct. And therefore, like, we have to think about, where does the power lie? Or is the power lying in, because for example, when DAOs were first proposed by Vitalik, his idea was a decentralized autonomous organization, was an organization that exists in cyberspace, like not controlled by any human being, that employ other human beings. The human beings work for the DAO. Not as like how we use it today, as there is a community that organize through this DAO together mutually to like achieve some goal. Where in a way that they couldn't do before. So the key part is about how we kind of shift our focus on our thinking. And my critique is how a lot
of... Hi, Amir, I lost you again. You were going to say what your critique was. Let me try to get you back in. Hello, Amir.
Hey,
you're back
again.
It's okay.
The other guy.
We'll kick the glowy out. All right.
Yeah, get rid of him.
Okay, awesome. So you were telling me what your actual critique of Ethereum was.
Yeah. So the critique, my critique of Ethereum is.
You're cutting out again, Amir. Amir, I lost you again, man. I think you're going to have to come back in. I can't hear you or see you. Okay. I guess you're back.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's all right,
sorry,
man.
I don't know. It's... I didn't
too
realize
many...
I should have connected to another hotspot.
It's okay. It's
anyway.
Okay. Maybe. All right, one second. Let me. All right, cool. All right, the glory's gone. Okay.
Okay, cool. Let's continue. So my critique of Ethereum is this human social engineering approach that is taken, which places the emphasis in the technology, which is a technology existing for its own sake, and the humans are consumed by this technology as a kind of resource, as opposed to how this technology exists inside of a complex framework of, you know, like society and politics and and how that technology is used to empower human beings. So that's kind of the objective or the goal. And it's also a critique that can be applied to Bitcoin as well, in some ways, in the ways that people talk about Bitcoin as being immutable, in the ways of, and in the way, and that immutable defense is partly a way of protecting Bitcoin from regulators. But I don't think it's the truth, and I don't think it will hold weight forever. So the community is going to have to come up with new concepts, you know, for how they explain the technology. So and in Bitcoin, they talk about how the Bitcoin is universal sound money. And the thing is, and this touch on my critique of like the kind of von Mises economic point of view, which is this deductive kind of logic or this kind of economic systems can only exist in a world where there is homogeneity, where there is uniformity, where nothing ever changes. As we see in markets, like, for example, meme coins pump, you know, like, and it's always a new meme coin that's coming out. Human beings are very much led by narrative, you know, like there's like, for example, sound money narrative or smart contracts or privacy coins or, you know, DAOs or DeFi. These are all different narrative, alternative L1s. The market ebbs and flows as narratives gain traction and lose traction. And that's not a bad thing. That's a healthy thing. You know, that's like, as human beings, like, we can add to this narrative. We can shape these narratives through the power of our argument. You know, we don't need to like resort to coercion. And so the problem is with the Bitcoin economic ideology is it doesn't give that community of people the proper tools that they need to properly understand economics. And so that weakens the Bitcoin as a project. And you, for example, see it with how defensive they get and how much they attack other projects. And actually what it's led is to this concentration of power, like with Bitcoin Core, where they attack other dev teams. They say it can only be one implementation of Bitcoin. Yet, as we know in crypto, protocols, it's actually very usual and it's actually standard practice for big projects to have multiple implementations by separate teams, to have a well-defined spec that the community can understand and read. In fact, like in Ethereum network in the early days, they had Geth and the Polkadot and the Dot client, the Parity client, and it was when the Geth team was in Taiwan that there was a what is it called, where the network gets flooded, I forgot the term, where the network gets flooded and it can't cope with the traffic and it goes denial of service. There's a denial of service attack on network and all the Geth nodes went down, and then Ethereum network was able to keep operating because it had this other implementation by Parity. And essentially what Bitcoin Core says is that there can only be one implementation of Bitcoin Core because it relies on quirks of C++, the programming language it's written in. But C++ is a fully specced language. There's no part of C++ language that's not specced. The only part of C++ that's not written in a specification is something called undefined behavior. And if your program at any point in time invokes undefined behavior, then the entire program is invalid. Like the compiler can compile your program to anything. So the Bitcoin Core team is saying that the Bitcoin cannot be specced because it relies on undefined behavior. It relies on bugs in the code, which are technically bugs in C++. So that is absolutely crazy, and so this is a very typical example of when groups of people gain power and they want to maintain that power simply because they do not have the mental tools to be able to to argue with other organizations or other people vying for power to justify their position of power, or in other words, what you were talking about, to give accountability for why they have that power. So that's why these new a whole emergent forms of organization in DAOs and DeFi are really important and should be encouraged, because they are allowing new forms of organizational structure to emerge, where firstly, power, ultimate power, resides with the people, and secondly, there are processes or forms of accountability in there. Now, when we talk about power being in the hands of the people, that's not to say that there should be no form of hierarchy. Like, in fact, hierarchy is necessary, as you alluded to, with economic systems. Everybody has a specialization. Everybody has some work that they do, and you know, there's people that are senior, there's people that's junior, there's people that, you know, have vision, there's people who get things done. You know, all of those people like make up a society, and it's not something that's bad. It's something that's actually, we are as a human beings like an organism. We form a body politic, you know, and we form. And so that comes on to the alternative definition of civilization that von Mises like eloquently put out, which is that, you know, we are different, we can look at society as individuals working together to form systems or subsystems, and those subsystems form supersystems, you know, going all the way up. And it's this kind of holistic thinking that's important for like how we like develop or improve our tooling. It's important that we develop these tools and we develop this like sophistication to be able to justify how we improve or develop these tools. And so I see that also coming partly out of the culture that's emerging. You know, there's an interesting article on Other Internet called Squad Wealth, where it's talking about, you know, now the form of organization that we should be talking about in the internet is squads, in a squad of people. You know, there's no defined like roles or specializations, but they have an objective, they have a shared mission. You know, they come together, they organize effectively to reach their goal. You know, squads organize with other squads. So I think that kind of thinking is kind of like how we ultimately achieve our objective of, you know, a political society which is empowering for people, which allows people to rise up, and, you know, allows people to be involved, to have a piece of power, to have stake in the economic and political system, you know, to be able to hold that power accountable.
Awesome. I mean, there's so much to talk about, Amir, and this conversation has definitely made me reconsider my stance. And I think after this conversation, I think I'm more of a lunar punk again. I was really, because wow. I mean, I can talk to you more about this, but I saw Bitcoin as the way by which we get rid of power, and I saw it getting rid of power through proof of work mining, where the economic incentives are so that the miners are the ones that call the shots, and no longer do we have a technocratic elite that calls the shots. That the only way to make changes to the ledger is by the miners actually voting, as you said, one CPU, one vote. My perspective of Bitcoin is very contrary to the main narrative, because I see the market in Bitcoin specializing, and miners and these CPUs that get one vote specializing over time, into like the ASICs we have now. So I always saw Bitcoin at governance being completely different. Bitcoin in its original design, that is, for its governance to be completely different from anything else in crypto, where the miners are the owners of the club, per se, who have the incentive to secure the network the most, because if they were to ever attack the network, it would be akin to committing suicide, because they no longer would be connected to other miner peers. So that was and is still my perspective. But I completely agree with you and my team that the surefire way to for us to focus on, and the most important thing for us to focus on, is the Lunar Punk route, in that we need to create these alternative systems, and privacy is definitely the way to go. So I'm gonna have in the description everything you talked about, even what you just mentioned about the squad. What do you call that? The squad.
Squad wealth.
Squad world, right? Okay.
Wealth.
Squad wealth.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to say about also Satoshi and anonymity. I think the way he I think when he I remember Bitcoin in 2010. A lot of us just assumed it was anonymous, you know, Silk Road, it used Bitcoin. People were like, oh yeah, we're anonymous, nobody knows, because it was literally random digits. But then, when we studied it a bit more, we kind of looked at it, we started to realize there's ways of de-anonymizing people. And that's why we started talking about CoinJoin. The original CoinJoin, by the way, I remember having this conversation with other Bitcoin devs, which I was saying, oh, you know, should the mix be with 10 people or 20 people? And they said, oh no, just do 2 people, because there's functionally no difference between 2 and 10. And that's what we thought back in 2012 or 2013, those times.
Wow.
Yeah. And then when Monero came out, I think I saw it and I was like, whoa, that looks very complicated, probably more than we need. But in hindsight, Monero was right at the time. It's so the anonymity, it hasn't been a constant. It hasn't been this is one breakthrough. It's even Tor now is broken. And that's why my friend Harry Halpin is working on NIM, which is a mixnet. It's an alternative to Tor, which is a proposal that he's worked on for the last decade. So we know that Tor's been broken, but Tor at one point used to be great technology. Now it's out of date. It's the old model that needs to be, we need to move on from. So I think it's literally just like that, you know, we keep coming up with new techniques, and we didn't, when Bitcoin came out, it was thought to be anonymous, but we later realized it's not anonymous, it's private. And then we thought, oh, it's not really private, it's pseudonymous. If you look at a lot of the early 2011 or 2012, people were talking about Bitcoin as if it's private. And also all the Chainalysis stuff today, it's advanced with artificial intelligence, machine learning. So it's even Monero, a lot of us have been saying for a long time that it's been cracked. And then recently now, Chainalysis has come out saying oh, we're offering Monero de-anonymization. So.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I know, I don't think that Monero is has been cracked, but because when I spoke to Howard Hsu, he explained to me that the anonymity set of Monero goes forward and backwards into time, and the only place where Monero has vulnerability is the moment that it leaves the exchange, and that only, from what I understand, only concerns ring signatures. But it doesn't concern ring confidential transactions or stealth addresses. So
So you know, I was the first to implement stealth addresses, which was proposed by Peter Todd. And stealth addresses, the only thing that they do is that it's like in Bitcoin, you know, when you reuse an address, then it's bad because you link the addresses. So the only thing the stealth addresses do is avoid address reuse. That's essentially what they do. So you can take your model, you can take your model of Bitcoin and you say, okay, imagine if everybody in Bitcoin never reused addresses. That would be stealth addresses. Confidential transactions, what they do is they hide the amounts. So Correct. Then you can take this model, you go, okay, the amounts are not there. And then ring signatures, we know they mix in. So we got this transaction graph, but now instead of the transaction graph being this person sent to this person, now we have it like could be this person, but it could also be these 10 other people. So the problem with that is that transaction graph, I think, still leaks a huge amount of info. You know, it's like it's, and even if the transaction graph would be 100, it's still not enough. Even if it's 1,000 or 10,000, it's still not enough because the state can fill it with fake transactions. So you think you're being mixed in, but actually your anonymity set is not 10. It's maybe more like 2 or 3, you know? So how many of those Monero transactions do we know are actually real in the blockchain? Because if I was a state, I'd just be making loads of transactions to fill it up.
So when we talk about Pirate Chain, we're talking about an anonymity set that is over like 500,000.
It's potentially infinite because it's like I can calculate. It's like 2 to the power of 32. That's what it would be. That's a huge number. Like it's like the size of the Merkle tree, which you can increase that if you really want to. You know, yeah, it's like some billion or something, like 4.3 billion, I think.
Yeah, there's been a lot of animosity coming from the Monero community towards the Pirate Chain community, which I told you uses private by default Z addresses. So that's the thing. It's like there's no reason for communities to like be antagonistic towards one another. Like we are all researching different technologies and moving forward. You know what I mean? So it's really cool to see you coming in and taking inventory of the space as it is. And I got your email regarding DarkFi where you actually announced DarkFi. I'm going to have that in the description below. Do you guys have a website yet?
Yeah, dark.fi.
Awesome. So for our next conversation, stay tuned, guys. We've already gone way over 2 hours. About 2 hours and a half. For our next conversation with Amir Taki, we're going to get deep into Monero and Pirate Chain and Dero. So we want to get deep into the state of privacy cryptography. Amir, would you be open to having other cryptographers here, other programmers?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, or cool. Maybe people from my team even as well. That'd be nice.
Dude, that would be awesome because you guys get to a level where I become a Luddite and I'm just like, whoa, and I would have to bring in guys from my team that actually can speak more eye to eye with you guys.
Brilliant.
But I mean, there's so much to talk about. I thank you so much for giving us your time. You've really said some things throughout this conversation that have made me reconsider my own views in terms of how much of a solar punk I am and made me realize that lunar punkness is the way to go. Now I'm using the language from the Ethereum crowd. So, how, you know, if you could give us any parting words because that would, you know, help with this tribalism that has begun to appear within the privacy coin space, that would, I think, would be very helpful.
Yeah, I'd say that they're going to come after, they're coming after all of us. And the simplest way to defeat us is divide and conquer. how everyone has been defeated for our history. It's the classic technique. You don't go after the strongest. First, you go after the weakest. You cut them out. You know, then you turn everyone against each other. You sow seeds of discontent, you know, and then the whole thing is weakened and they can't mount a proper defense. So that's essentially, we have to stand united because they're going to come after all of us. And now it's like, I think a lot of this is just like laying the groundwork to divide us. Together we stand, you know, united we stand and divided we fall.
Thank you, Amir, for your time. And don't hang up. I want to talk to you a little more before you leave. But guys, peace, love, anarchy. We're definitely going to continue this conversation because we're just at the tip of the iceberg, guys. There's a lot to talk about here. Thank you, Amir, for your time.
Thank you, guys. Thanks a lot.
Financial slavery is a bitch because it doesn't let you think. That's the whole point. Don't give you time to think. If you want to really learn philosophy, you need leisure. Leisure. Crypto is here to give you the leisure so you can think.